History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some untold stories right around you that really should be untold no more. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we do that, we learn a lot. We're educated. We're entertained. So often, we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Of the more than 16 million Americans who served in uniform during World War II, fewer than 20,000 of them, that's a little more than one-tenth of 1%, were Americans of Chinese ancestry. In other words, it's not every day we get to meet a Chinese-American veteran, but chances are you've never met anyone quite like Ray Lee, 95 years old, of Fresno, California. We're going to learn a lot about him today, and let's start with the early years. Born in San Francisco, he was raised initially in Fresno by his Chinese immigrant grandmother after his mother left the family to pursue an acting career. What do you remember about your childhood, Ray?
Grandma took care of us when we were kids, and she was really strict, disciplined us, and we had chores to do to keep us out of trouble. In fact, we lived in Fresno for quite a few years till we were able to move over to Kalingo. My dad had a restaurant over there, so we went over there, stayed over there, and started my schooling there, and graduated from high school in 42.
What was it like here in Fresno in the 20s and 30s?
Well, the population was small, and it wasn't congested like it is now. You can able to get around. People were more friendlier, and we kept to ourselves, and we lived in Germantown. We had a lot of German friends we had, and my landlord was German. We rented a house from them. It was $18 a month. That was a lot of money in those days, yeah, and it was quite an experience.
Well, and I've heard some stories about Chinatown back in the day. Do you have any memories of Fresno's Chinatown?
Yes, I do. I went to Chinese school. My grandma insists that we all go to Chinese school to learn the language. And I went to two schools, one on G Street between Mariposa and Tulare on G Street. That was an old brick building. It was kind of a spooky place. It's a really spooky old building. Yeah, we had most of the Chinese kids going to school there. And I had one rough teacher. He was a mean son of a gun. I never forget him. Yeah.
Well, I heard you say the word spooky, and I'm reminded of some of the stories I've heard that people talk about tunnels underneath Chinatown, and maybe some of those are haunted. Did you ever see or hear any of that?
I never seen a tunnel, but I've been in the China Alley. It's a spooky old place between Tulare and Mariposa Street. That's where the old Chinese school, and it was a spooky old building. It's all these buildings all run down, and a lot of these Chinese family had no place to go, but they had to live in those old brick buildings. It was pretty rough.
Sometimes people remember this and sometimes they don't, but I'm always curious, if you think back to when you were that boy growing up, did you have some dreams or some ambitions or those thoughts, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do?
No, we didn't have anything like that. The only thing we had in mind, we were supposed to learn the language and behave ourselves and try and get ahead in our education. That was taught by our grandparents. They insist that we all go to school, learn the language, and try to prove to the people that you are somebody. Make something out of your life.
In Fresno, in this area at the time, did you feel that you were treated any differently because you were Chinese?
Yes, we had a segregation. Southern Pacific Railroad track, that was the line that we cannot cross. Cannot go over that Southern Pacific. That was it. We were supposed to stay in that boundary line.
What would happen if you didn't?
People would ask, what are you doing over here? Get back over there on the west side. We didn't want to argue with it, so we just turn around and go back.
Did that bother you at all at the time, or was that just the way life was?
Well, it kind of set me off. And then when I was a kid, it kind of set me off. But always have a memory of that, not to go beyond the Southern Pacific Railroad track. And finally, after the war, things loosened up, and we were allowed to go across that track, go to the theater over there, the Warner Brothers, Wilson, Kinema, and the Hardy, and the Fulton Street Theater. There's quite a few of them over there.
And how old were you when you moved from Fresno to Coalinga?
Oh, I was about 14, 15 years old when I moved over to Coalinga.
And that changed your life a little bit, it sounds like, huh?
Yes, it did. We had hardly any Oriental student over there. We had mostly the white kids. We got along real fine. Some of those kids are one of my best friends. We had made a lot of good friends over there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were down to earth.
The history of Coalinga was that it was a big oil town, right? And your dad had a Chinese restaurant there?
Yes, he did. The first Chinese restaurant there. We had a Buckley Hotel. And down below used to be a bar. And it was a vacant place, so my dad happened to talk to the landlord, and she rented an office to us, the half of the building, mm-hmm. upstairs and downstairs. It was interesting, yeah.
What was the restaurant called?
It was called a China Cafe. My dad, I used to run those kids out, the high school kids used to come in and raise hell on a Saturday night. My dad used to go out to the front dining room and tell them to calm down or get the heck out of that place here. they respected my dad because my dad was quite a fighter. He was a very athletic type of a gentleman. He was a fighter.
And did all four of you kids have to work in the restaurant?
Yes, we did. That kept us out of trouble. We had to finish up schooling, and we come after school, we'll go down to the restaurant to work till about 8-9 o'clock, then we go home.
So what'd you have to do at the restaurant?
Well, we had to peel the vegetable, onion, dry onion, a green onion. We stand on a soapbox on top of a sink and wash dishes and sweep the floor, mop the floor, clean the latrine and stuff like that. We had odds and ends, a lot of work to do in the restaurant. You fill up the salt, pepper, fill up the napkin dispenser. We had a lot of things to do. We couldn't mess around. My dad was watching us, and we had to do what he tells us to do.
And so Coalinga High School at the time, sounds like your family were some of the only Asian faces there?
We had about two Asian family beside ourselves, one Korean and two Chinese family. Two of them was running a grocery store, and one had one Korean family working out in the oil field, Standard 25D, and that was about it.
Well, you told me your class of 1942, so that tells me that your senior year at Coalinga High School, the world changed a little bit. Do you remember December 7th, 1941?
You better believe it. Me and my dad was going down to the restaurant. We were riding in this vehicle, and then we got to the back alley. We pulled in, and our neighbor next door, he had a dry cleaning establishment, and he hollered over the fence that Pearl Harbor had been attacked by the Japanese. And we didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. I said, "Where's Pearl Harbor?" My dad said, "I don't know." He asked me, "Do you know where it is?" I said, "No, I don't." So we had the radio going on all night and found out it was in Hawaii. And it was quite a shock, yeah. And then we was thinking, geez, we're going to have to get involved in this, which we did.
Well, and what was it like at school the next day?
Everybody knew about Pearl Harbor. Everybody was in a state of shock. And we had several high school students that graduated before our class did. They were in the military. Some of them were lost in Corregidor and when they got overrun by the Japanese in the Philippines.
So you knew some of those guys?
Yes. They used to come in the restaurant all the time. We'd get to know them. And then they all enlisted in the Army. Some went in the Signal Corps, and some went in the regular department. And we all knew that they were all in the Pacific, in the Philippines, and they were all taken prisoner, or we didn't know what happened to them.
So they could have been on the Bataan Death March?
Yeah, they could have. We never heard from them anymore. There was quite a few people missing from Coalinga, quite a casualty from Coalinga.
Have you ever found out anything more over the years about what happened to them?
No, I didn't. Since then, we moved out of Coalinga, so we lost track of those gentlemen. One was a Mice. I forgot his first name. We call him Apple Mice. he had a brother over there, worked for the Chevrolet garage. And he used to come in to the restaurant all the time, order fried rice. He loved fried rice. We call him Apple. I got a nickname for him.
Well, and you know, I've talked to a lot of Japanese Americans who were in this area at the time, and I've heard how their life changed, and of course, they got locked up and put behind barbed wire. But I've also heard stories about Chinese Americans being mistaken for Japanese Americans. Is that something that happened to you?
Yes, they did. I was stationed at Camp Cook. I decided to take a weekend pass to go to Santa Barbara. So I took a weekend pass, and I was walking down the sidewalk by myself, and two Marines were walking toward me. And they were talking to each other. I knew they were up to something no good. They were recruits. They come toward me, and they walked me right off the sidewalk. I didn't say anything. I just went off the sidewalk, and that was it. And they turned around and looked at it and started laughing. I said, okay. I said, in case I find you on the battlefield, I'll start laughing at you. Remember what happened. But anyhow, I didn't see those guys anymore. They were recruits.
Well, when did you end up in the Army? And what about your brother? Which one of you went in the service first?
My brother did. He went in the Navy first. And I tried to get in the Navy, but they were all, the quota was all filled up. I tried to get in the Air Force, the quota was filled up. So I tried the organization that I really liked, but there was no opening. So I decided, I'm not going to wait any longer. I went down the draft board, told my I want an immediate induction. I want to get this thing over with. So I volunteered, had the draft board take me in.
How did your family feel about that, about you and your brother going off to war?
Well, they had no choice. They knew that we had to do it. We had to go and do our duty. We had to go and show people that we were proud of what we are, so we all volunteered.
I guess that's something I should ask, too. Did you have family in China that you were aware of that maybe had been oppressed by the Japanese?
No, we had, my grandma did, but she lost track of them, but I had no knowledge of them. She didn't say too much, but she always sent money back to the village where she came from to support the family. She tried everything she did financially to help him. She was a good grandma.
I get the sense she had a pretty big influence in your life.
She sure did, man. But she said, jump. You asked how high you jump. Man, she was strict. And that's how we turned out. We turned out real good.
Well, what was it like when you did enter the Army? You said you wanted to get in the Navy or the Air Corps, and it didn't happen, so you're in the Army. Did you have an idea of what they'd do with you?
No, I didn't. In fact, they didn't tell us where we were going after we got our equipment and clothing issued to us at Presidio Monterey. They got us all on this train, and they didn't tell us where we were headed for. So we rode the train for 2 nights and 2 days or something like that. It was a long train ride, and we was going down the southern route, New Mexico, down in there. One morning, we were still sleeping, the train stopped. I said, hey, the train stopped, I told my buddy. Pretty soon, we heard a big military band out there playing Deep in the Heart of Texas. I said, we're in Texas. We landed in Austin, Texas, Bastrop, Texas. That's a small town like Pinedale. Camp Swift, that was a base we were had a basic training. They run the hell out of us, man. We were all 18 years old. And they got us off the train early in the morning, and they had us stand in formation, and they had these 2.5-ton trucks standing by, about 4 or 5 of them, and the sergeant in charge, he had a list, and he hollered out the name, and we say, ho, say, truck one, and call another name, truck two, 3, 4 trucks. So we jumped in the truck. When they called me, they, truck four. I said, what the hell are we in? We're in the Army, but we don't know what outfit. Anyhow, we didn't know. So they pulled guys out, put them on different truck. They shipped them to infantry outfit and engineer and headquarters. When we found out we was a medic, I said, hey, I don't know anything about medics, medicine. You know, the guy said, you soon learn how to do things like that. So we was in the medics.
Well, and I want to hear what they taught you about that, but I guess I should ask too, because you mentioned at Kalinga High, you said, I think, 3 Asian families in town. What about in that whole group of new guys in the Army, all these 18-year-olds?
No, except when we got to the camp. They had a cattery. They had Asian cooks in there. Asian cook and an Asian sergeant from L.A., Sergeant Clarence King, who was a good cook. He gave us a good meal.
The reason I ask is I think, especially young people today, they're shocked when they hear that the military was segregated in World War II and that, you know, there are all black units and all Japanese-American units. But then, you know, Mexican-Americans, Chinese-Americans would get sprinkled in with all these white soldiers. You're all wearing the same uniform. Did you feel that unity or did they make you feel different?
No, they didn't. I got along with all these guys. They accepted me. I'd mind my own business, did what they told me to do. I don't know, I mind my own business. I didn't give them any bad time. I just did what they told me to do.
Well, and you said you didn't know anything about being a medic. So what did they teach you about that?
They made a selection in a group of our company to send some up in Colorado, one to Fort Simmons. That's a hospital up there. And then they sent me down to Beaumont General Hospital in El Paso. I went to school there. And then they sent people back east to California. Oh, different general hospital, military hospital. They have an instructor there, teach you the main thing about first aid, all the medication, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. What to do, how to do it, stuff like that. We learn a lot.
And while you're getting all that training, your brother is flying with the Navy?
Yes. He was stationed in South America. He usually tell me he goes on a patrol watching for submarines, stuff like that. They had a lot of German submarines in that area. Of course, the German and Argentina country were buddies, so they had a watch for him.
If you pull up the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, you'll find a photo of Ray's brother Warren in his World War II Naval Aviator's uniform, as well as one of Ray in the uniform of the 97th Infantry Division. We're going to hear how he was training to go to the Pacific, but first ended up in Europe, and hear some of the things he encountered there. Not only did he give our country some of his best years in World War II, Ray later spent 27 years helping to establish and maintain an outstanding Veterans Museum in Fresno, California, where he still lives today. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with one of the few remaining Chinese-American veterans of World War II. Ray Lee is 95 years old, but you never know it if you saw him mowing his own lawn or getting together with his weekly honeydew club at McDonald's. After graduating from Coalinga High School in Coalinga, California, where he and his siblings had worked in his father's restaurant, China Cafe, he tried to enlist in the Navy and the Army Air Corps, but those quotas were full, so he volunteered for induction into the Army in February 1943. Ray would become a medic with Company C of the 322nd Medical Battalion in the 97th Infantry Division.
After we left Fort Leavenworth, Missouri, they sent us to camps San Luis Obispo for amphibious training. When they say amphibious training, I knew where we were headed for, Pacific. So we took a Camp Cook, went to Camp Cook, Camp San Luis Obispo. They run us up and down the Pacific coast, landing on the 101 highway. They had to stop the traffic, and we had to land there and participate in invasion. All infantry guys go up the hill, and we come in with the LCVP, and we had the life belt around our side, and then we drop. As soon as we hit the beach, we drop the life belt, and then you run. You can't run. Everybody was seasick. Sand was sandy. You know how sandy? You're trying to carry heavy equipment, a litter or something like that. You just can't move. Just like you're just paralyzed. And the Marine standing there, he was instructing us, run, run, get off of the ground, run. Trying to get us off the ground. We were too sick, seasick. We were riding in those LCVP, the circle, smelling the diesel smoke. Everybody was sick.
That doesn't sound very encouraging. That wouldn't give you a whole lot of confidence to do that for real overseas.
Well, we were supposed to land, our division was supposed to land in Tokyo Bay. There were three divisions involved, the 95th, the 97th, and the 104th. We were supposed to be the frontal attack. We were supposed to be involved in that. Good thing I signed an armistice. Otherwise, I won't be around to tell you what happened. Yeah. But anyhow, the war came to a halt, so we landed. They didn't have no pier to unload the troops. We had to take our LCVP, hit the beach, get off, just like you're making a dry run on an invasion.
But you saw a whole lot more of the world before that. So you're training for the Pacific, but then the Battle of the Bulge happens, and there's casualties, casualties, casualties. So they pull your division and say, you're going to Europe?
I was surprised. I thank the Lord that we were going back to Europe instead of going to the Pacific. If we'd gone to the Pacific, I wouldn't be here to tell you what I was involved in. Anyhow, we order changed, so we had to go back to Camp Kilmer. Well, that's where we shipped out, POE. Wake up next morning, I'd never seen so many ships around us. Man, there was a whole bunch of ships.
So what did you encounter once you got to Europe?
Well, shocked me when we landed in Le Havre, France, and then we all took off, get into the 2.5-ton truck that took us to Faye Camp. And I looked around at the harbor, everything was all shot up, burned, completely demolished. I'd never seen so much wreckage. Man, it was a shock. And then we went to the village, and I seen burnt-out buildings, and it was more of a shock. And then they got us to Camp Lucky Strike. They had Camp Lucky Strike, Camp Ogo, Camp different cigarette. They had different camp to prepare yourself to get ready to go to get assigned to one of the army that's on the line. So the engineer had us learn how to dig up mines, landmines, booby traps. We didn't know anything about it. They were blowing off explosives all the time just to get us used to the sound. And that was kind of scary. And then we had to learn how to dig up the mine. I had three guys in the line go out and dig up the mine, Teller mine, glass mine, S mine, and I didn't know what the heck S mine and booby trap, all that stuff, but I sure learned a lot. The engineer was blowing up explosives just to get us accustomed to it.
Here you're trained to be a medic, and now they're saying you're going to be disabling these mines that can kill you if you make a wrong move. How nerve-wracking is that to try to pull up a mine without it going off?
Well, they're teaching us when you probe into the ground, you go at a certain degree. You don't go directly on top. You might set off that explosive. So they tell us when you dig up a mine, you holler mine, two of your buddy back off, and you're responsible for the mine. And he said, never dig up the first mine. They have another one behind it, the pressure mine underneath it. You lift off the top, another one goes off. The German know are really smart. They were really clever. Everything that they manufactured was right to the teeth. Not like a Mickey Mouse. They were completely to the teeth. They got fine equipment.
I'm just thinking, is that where you celebrated your 21st birthday? In Europe, right after you got there?
Well, I didn't have time to think about that. All I was thinking about, hoping the heck I'd come out alive. That was the main thing. We were thinking about that. We don't want to step on a mine, and that was it. They got a lot of mine out there. Yeah. So they had to light up an area with a ribbon, stay on the path. Otherwise, a lot of mine feel around you. Especially in France, they had a lot of mine feel I didn't know what a mine was, but I shouldn't find out.
I'm sure there are a lot of things that you saw that you'd never seen before. Where all did you guys go with the 97th Infantry Division?
Well, we were assigned to the Rhine River. We had to clean up the Ruhr Pocket. They had a pocket up there where our division went up there and cleaned it out. And we took Cologne and Dusseldorf, those two big cities. Just kept going. We were assigned to old General Patton. That guy, he didn't know when to stop. It was constantly going, you know. Every time we could start going, I said, where are we headed for? Nobody knows. We're just going, got our orders to head straight ahead. We go end up in Czechoslovakia. We liberated Pilsen. Our division liberated Pilsen. And then we went 3-4 miles out of Pilsen to a little small town, Mies, M-I-E-S. That's when we got ordered to come back because General Patton wanted to go to Berlin. We were headed for Berlin. It was over there in the end of Czechoslovakia. We were going to head to Berlin, and Eisenhower told him to come back, let the Russians take the casualty. So we came back to Germany again, regroup ourselves.
Well, and speaking of casualties, I mean, this is what you trained for, caring for casualties. Yeah. Did you ever get to do that?
Yes, we did. Well, we had a lot of casualties. We were working in an aid station. One of our unit, we got captured. They were assigned to another infantry outfit. They had about 2 ambulances and about 4 guys to a litter, a little, 4-litter squad there. And the German came in and got them that night. One guy stuck a P-38 right in the guy's face. Grouch, 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 grouch. They took them out. They took 2 ambulances and 4-litter squad and some casualty, American casualty, took them. And they took them, and about a week later, they turned them loose.
This was near the end of the war in Europe, but I want to explore a little more of what happened leading up to VE Day. And since we're recording this here at the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor, where you volunteered for 27 years, and everybody listening should check out the photos and video of that at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. But I think there are some pretty relevant items here in the Ray Lee Room at the museum. We see the helmets with the Red Cross painted on them, just like you wore. And we even see the field medic kit that you would carry with scissors and bandages and morphine and everything else in there. Can you give me an example or a memory of how you would have used that kit in the field?
I was up there at the battalion aid station, and we would have some patient come in. They were wounded. Well, we had a battalion surgeon. He would check them out and decide what to give them. So we would follow up on the battalion surgeon's order, we give them bandages and few things like medication, stuff like that. In a serious case, we would send them back to the clearing company. They would send them back to an evacuation hospital where they had more equipment to take care of the person. We just have just a minor item up as like having a Band-Aid. We just give them Band-Aid treatment. That's all we had up there. We didn't have all the heavy equipment like the evacuation hospital.
So are you saying you didn't see too many of the serious wounds? Or were there some things that you witnessed that you still think back on and you say, man, that guy sacrificed a lot for his country?
Yeah, you know, I've seen some, I don't want to talk about it, I've seen some pretty bad stuff. We had some German prisoner come in, the poor guy was shot up pretty bad, and we couldn't travel at night. We stayed indoor because if you travel at night, you would get shot. So we stayed in a little house, and this guy, German prisoner, was in the other room. He was moaning all night long. Man, we couldn't sleep. He was moaning all night long till daylight, and it was pretty hard to take. And in the morning, we evacuated him on a litter. We took him out, get ready to put him in the ambulance, and I said, he's gone. Don't use put him in the ambulance. We might as well leave him right here for the German civilian to put him away. You know, that was something I never forget.
Did that experience of being a medic with the 97th Infantry Division as you're going across Europe, you know, in early 1945, did that give you an impression or an understanding of how much courage these American soldiers had? Can you maybe give us an example that comes to mind of what illustrated that for you?
Well, we came up on the Rhine River at night. We were assigned on a certain area, and it was raining cats and dogs and lightning, and we were standing out there like some troop back over to the German side. They were setting, both sides were reconnaissance on reconnaissance, and they were checking our defense out, and we were checking those guys out. And finally, we got word that the 101st Airborne was going to take that position, so we moved out. The 101st came in, took the line of defense right there on the Rhine River. I was glad I didn't have no weapon. Boy, I sure feel naked out there. What are we doing out here? It was just like a bunch of jaybirds, you know, no weapon, just a medical kit. That was crazy.
And how did you cross the Rhine?
Crossed the Rhine, they had a pontoon bridge. An engineer got together, got the pontoon bridge, so we went across in an ambulance. We had an ambulance. Our company had some ambulance, and I was in the litter platoon. We did all the dirty work, you know. The other guy, they sit back and they were in the luxury. We did the dirty work.
Well, I've got to ask you what that means. What was the dirty work? What were the dirty things you had to do?
Well, yeah, we have a latrine pit, garbage pit. Well, we had to dig all that stuff for the wheels. We had three platoons in our company. We had a station platoon. We had a ambulance platoon. And I was in a litter platoon. We did all the dirty work. And we were considered unmentionable. It was a good experience. Yeah, learned a lot.
What about close calls that you experience? Do you remember sometimes, I mean, you just told me about the Rhine River where you're a little nervous, but were there some situations where you realized how close you were to getting wounded or getting killed?
Well, there was three of us. We were standing out in a little village in a courtyard and was out there chewing a rag. Three of us were standing there. Pretty soon I heard a boom. Incoming mail. Boy, when I heard the incoming boom, We took off. Those three guys and myself, we hit the stairwell and we all got up and started laughing. Pretty soon we heard another boom. So I took off again. I ran around the house and I seen this big old bomb shelter. I was going to jump in there, but I lift up the lid. I looked down there and there was some German civilian in there. I said, oh, no, not for me to be jumping in there. So I dropped the old trap door and I went around the house. I dug me a foxhole from the other side where the shell was coming in. So that was one of my scariest moments.
Well, that's one of the questions that came to mind. What were the scariest things you had to deal with? Because at different times, I mean, you could have bombers going overhead, you could have artillery coming in, mortar fire, machine gun fire, mines. What was the scariest thing for you?
Well, a company commander, he was the one that got orders from the higher up echelon to tell us where to move. So we moved into this little town, little village like, and we seen a lot of white sheet hanging out on the window of the doors in the village, and we was out there chewing a rag. Pretty soon I looked up, there was a company of infantry was coming up the road. There were platoon size, they were on each side of the road, and the captain was leading them, and he come up to me and he said, "What are you people doing up here?" I said, "Isn't this town taken?" He said, "Hell no." And I said, "Wow, we're in trouble." So I took off, and he continued his way up forward. That was the closest I ever seen. We took the town without knowing it wasn't taken. Man, I tell you, the OC, the company commander, he really, really screwed up and almost got us all killed. Good thing this infantry company came out and asked us what the hell we was doing up here.
So you're walking around without a care, not knowing you're in danger and there's enemy all around you.
Yeah, that's true. We heard shots going on, firing going on. We didn't know what was going on until they came up and told us we were not supposed to be up there. And we were up there ahead of the infantry. Boy, I tell you, that was one of the screwiest moments I've ever experienced.
And I know some of the stuff is difficult to talk about, and I'm not trying to twist your arm. So if you say you don't want to talk about it, don't. You're 95 years old now. It's been 75 years since all this happened. Are there days where you still, in your mind, see or hear or smell something from 75 years ago?
Well, I never forget the smell of death. It's something that you never forget the smell. A body odor, it's one smell you never forget. They had a lot of these cases come up. They were on the wagon. They were all covered with straw. And we were downwind, and then we got a pretty good whiff of it, and we knew exactly what was going on when we got the smell. They were carrying these civilians. They were all on the big wagon. They were covered with straw. All you see was just feet hanging out, bare feet hanging out, and you never forget. There was quite a few civilian casualties I seen, and the smell was horrific, especially when you're downwind.
Did you have a clear understanding of what you were doing there and why it was so important for all you Americans to be there?
Well, we were in there for the service of our country, to liberate the country and help the people out. That was our job. And I was kind of happy to be one of the group that was there to help the people out, liberate and serve my country. And I appreciate for what the country had done for us since I was a kid.
And we're going to hear more of what he did for our country when we come back, plus how he's helped preserve history through the Veterans Memorial Museum in Fresno, California, where there's even a room named in his honor. Check out the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll have more with 95-year-old Ray Lee when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 95-year-old Ray Lee of Fresno, California, a medic with the 97th Infantry Division in Europe during World War II. He later saw occupation duty in Japan as well, and in his home you'll find some unique souvenirs from both of those theaters of war. This interview was recorded at the Veterans Memorial Museum in Fresno, where Ray volunteered for 27 years. They're looking for additional volunteers now. If you think you might be interested and you live around there, the information is linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. One thing we haven't discussed yet is what Ray witnessed in April 1945, when German SS troops were trying to evacuate emaciated prisoners from the Flossenbürg concentration camp, only to be foiled by the liberating forces from the 90th Infantry Division, the 11th Armored Division, and Ray's Infantry Division, the 97th.
Well, you know, we hit one town in Germany. Me and my buddy from Missouri, we decided to take a little walk, see this little town. We were stationed in this town, and we came around a little corner, and all of a sudden, there were three or four Jewish POW who were dressed in black and white stripe. They had a yellow patch over the left side of the uniform, and when they seen us, I was shocked. We came head on around this corner, and he grabbed us and tried to hug us, and I was trying to fight him off, tell him, no, I don't want to touch him because they were all contaminated. So me and my buddy was fighting him off, trying to tell him to get away from us. We don't want to get too close to him. So anyhow, I'd never seen them. They were in real bad shape. They were all skins and bone. They were all dressed in a black and white stripe. They had a gold star over the left heart. They invited us over to the concentration camp, so we went along with them, and they gave us some liquor to celebrate the release of them. Now, I didn't take it, but my buddy from Missouri, he took a swig of it, and he said, boy, that stuff is strong. He said, boy, shook his head. I said, I'm glad I didn't take it. And I said, no, I don't want it, I don't want it. They took me in the concentration camp. I seen Polish people, I seen Italian, I seen English, I seen Gypsy, I seen all kind of nationality in this concentration camp. And boy, I said, this is one hell of a place to be. Oh man, that's terrible. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's what I wonder. It's not like you've led a privileged life. I mean, you've had to work hard. You grew up without your mother. You heard your grandmother's story of immigrating from China to be a laborer here in America. But to see that kind of suffering, to see people in that kind of physical shape, how much of a jolt was that to you? How did that affect you?
Boy, it was a shock, complete shock. I'd never seen anything like this before in my life. This was an eye-opener. It really showed me how people were treated. I'd never seen people like that in that shape, and they were in really bad shape. And one time we had brought one Jewish casualty into the aid station. He was covered with feces. He smelled so bad we couldn't get near him. And he was all caked up on his body, and his whole face, everything was caked up with feces. And he told us, we had a couple of Jewish GI in our office. We had to call one of them in and have him interpret what this guy was telling us. And he said there were 30 of them to begin with, and he's the only one left. They had him in this pen, that feces all over the place. He was laying in there for almost a month. And we brought him in. We couldn't get close to him. He smelled so bad. Yeah, it was really bad. The other 30 passed away. They died. He was the only survivor. He was the only one left. He was in bad shape.
Is there anything else from those months that you spent in Europe with the 97th Infantry Division that stands out to you today that you think the rest of us ought to know?
Well, I put in 3 years and 3 days with the service, and I learned a lot. Learned how to control myself, how to take care of people, and how to respect people and stuff like that. It makes you grow up faster, become independent, and you can take care of yourself. You know how to greet people and mix with people, things like that. It helps. You know, being in a service, you learn a lot.
Well, what does it feel like to walk around the museum and see stuff still hanging where you put it, or displays that are still where you built them? How satisfying is that for you?
Well, it's a great honor to have people giving us a good remark on the job that I had performed for them.
Every hallway that I walk through here and every room seems to have dozens of framed items on the wall. How many frames do you think you put together and hung in this place?
Well, since I've been here, I believe I hung about 500 to 600 pictures.
So you were here for 27 years, and now you get here every once in a while. What does it mean to you to come back and to see how the other guys are carrying on what you started?
Well, there's few older people left, and there's some new people that just volunteered to help out. Everything seemed to be in order, as I can see. There's a few changes. They brought in some new items that I never did seen before. Really pepped up the museum display for people to see.
Well, and there's one little section of the wall where it has some really nice things to say about somebody, and it has a picture of a guy smiling in a tuxedo, and it says right above it with a big arrow pointing to the right, the Ray Lee Room. What does that mean to you to have an entire room in this beautiful museum named after you?
Well, it's an honor to have my name put on the wall. It's making me feel so good, all the hard time we had putting the museum together. It was quite a job, and I appreciate their putting my picture up on the wall.
Can you take me back to the beginning and tell me the story of how you first got involved here?
I was at home watching TV, and they had a short snap of the museum of a person on a litter. And this gentleman on the litter was all bandaged up, covered up with a GI blanket, and that created some interest in me. So I was with the city of Fresno. My 25 year came up, and then I decided I would spend a little more time with the museum because I had no other way to have a hobby. So I decided to come down and volunteer at the museum. As I came to the front door with some item I had, Chuck Mungus was trying to spray a 4x8 plywood, and Mr. Warren McGuire, he was on his hands and knees working on an electrical system. Of course, he was a ham operator. He knew what the deal was about wiring. And I looked at Chuck, I said, "Sir, you need some help." Next thing I knew, I was working down there as a volunteer. So he recruited me, so I came back and helped him out, and we came a long ways.
Yeah, you didn't know you were signing up for 27 years, did you?
No, I didn't decide. I didn't know I was going to be here for 27 years. But the item keeps coming in, and we got to have some place to display the item. We ran out of room, and things got pretty hectic. So I decided my time was up. I decided to let the other fellows take the job. So I left. I retired.
Well, and right now they're looking for some more volunteers. They said they could really use about 5 more guys to come down here and help. So if there's somebody out there listening that's saying, hey, maybe I should do that, what would be your sales pitch? Why should they consider that?
Well, if you're building a service, you know how it is. You try to keep things going forward. Being a GI, being in the military, it's good to reminisce with the fellows and talk about old times, and same time do a few things around the museum, help display. And we have a lot of people that comes in from different parts of the country. We have people come in from China, Korea, and Germany, different country. You'll be surprised how many people, foreign people, come in to see this museum. It's one of the best museums I've ever seen before. They made comments about it and congratulate all of us for helping out.
And I know it's hard to pick one, because just where I'm sitting now, I'm looking at a bunch of frames on the wall of paintings and lithographs that you put up. You've framed photographs. You've done big display cases where the names of local people who've won the Silver Star, been awarded the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart, Distinguished Flying Cross, all these prestigious medals. There's so many things that you've done around here. And other than that sign that says the Ray Lee Room, is there one spot in the museum that you always want to go see again when you come back here?
I enjoy coming back, seeing the fellows and seeing the new volunteers and looking around. I take a little short walk and I see the museum is still in good shape. We have display of World War I, World War II, and Korea, Vietnam, Desert Storm, all that campaign that we were all involved in. We have it in the showcases. It's a very nice display for people to see.
Where'd all those showcases come from?
All the showcases, we had a lady that came in and talked to me. She said she works for JCPenney, and they were going to remodel the whole store. And I said, what about the showcases? She said, if you come down early enough, I'll talk to the manager and have them give it to you for the purpose of having a museum to display all our items. And it turned out real nice. That's the reason why all the showcases are uniform. They look uniform. They're in pretty good shape when we got them.
And there's a giant moving model of a B-17 that you helped hang up there. And then one of the more striking parts of this museum is the grand foyer when you walk in. And on the wall, just about every side of the wall, there are these giant oversized images of those distinguished medals, the Medal of Honor, the Distinguished Service Cross, the Navy Cross, the Air Force Cross. How did all those get way up there? Because they're pretty high up.
You better believe it. We had a scissor jack. The city loaned us a scissor jack, and I was one of the person that helped wire the metal frame up. Used quarter-inch cable, aircraft cable, and we had a scissor ladder that goes up about 15 feet. That's pretty high up there. We had to hang them up on a hook, like the Purple Heart, Silver Star, Bronze Star, and all your high medal for that people have won. If you've been in the service and feel patriotic about the country, this is the place to come down and see what all the young fellow that volunteer who has passed away or killed in action or WIA wounded in action. We have all these people come in. We really appreciate your people coming to see what these young fellows have done during the wartime.
And how often over all these decades have you ever encountered someone else who was a Chinese-American veteran?
There was quite a few that were living in Fresno, but they all passed away. I guess I'm the only one left. Quite a few of them went to volunteer for the Army, and they were sent to China because they could speak the language over there. And quite a few people like that with different languages, send them to different, to their parents' country where they speak the languages, get along with the people. I was sent to Japan after we finished up in Europe, spent 8 months over there in Nagano, and the Japanese people accepted me. They looked at me and wondered what I was doing in the United States Army. Well, I had a fib. I told my parents was Japanese, and my other parents was Chinese. We were kind of mixed up. And they couldn't figure out what I was doing in the Army, wearing an American uniform. I was the talk of the village at the time. They seemed very interested in me. I was well-treated over there. It was quite an experience for me.
So you were just pulling their leg, telling them you were half Japanese?
Yes, I had to fib a little bit and make them accept me. I used to go out at night and go to this Japanese opera theater. I walked in there, they all turned around, looked at me, start talking, whispering, looking at me, and trying to figure out what the heck I was doing in American uniform. I had a fib and told them I was half Japanese, half American, or Chinese. They sent me away up to Nagano to a man, a 10-bed hospital. Nagano, I was the only medic, so I went up there by myself. I traveled by train. That was the only transportation we had at the time, the Japanese. Everything was all shot up pretty bad. I had a major up there, just me and him. We used to go around and check on these places. That was the only thing I could think of at the time. They had a 10-bed up there, but I was the only medic up there, and my medical supply had to go take a train, go back down to division headquarters, pick up my medical supply, and go back on the train, back up to Nagano. It was quite a trip, very interesting.
And were your patients wounded Americans or were they Japanese?
Well, I had some American soldiers up there. There was just a few. I didn't see very many of them. The Japanese civilian, they would approach me and ask me for some medication. I would give them whatever I had just to help them out. And word got around, the whole village was coming up and asking me for medication. I told them I couldn't give you them all the medication I had. I'd give you a few, like aspirin and a few ointments like that.
Did that give you some perspective to see the devastation, the destruction, and the situation those Japanese people found themselves in?
Boy, I was shocked when we landed in Japan, Tokyo. Everything was burned up to the ground. They put us in the Nakajima aircraft near Kumagaya, and we had all the GI. We had about at least 300 in one big hangar. We all slept in the hangar, and then they got things organized. Then each organization went a different way. They were stationed throughout Japan as occupation.
At 95 years old, what are you most proud of?
I'm still kicking. That's the main thing. I'm still alive. And I look around, most of my buddies are gone. I'm very fortunate. The man upstairs taking care of me, so I'm very grateful for that.
And I know you get asked this a lot, so I'm sure you have a good answer. What's your secret? You're 95, and you walk straighter and faster than people 30 years younger. What's your secret?
Well, I was in the infantry. I learned how to walk, and we walked quite a few miles, and I acquired that habit, and I still have a habit. I walk quite a bit, and I exercise in the backyard, do a lot of garden work, but I walk. I never forget walking. I used to hike all the time. Every time they say, let's go, we all go. We walk about 10, 15 miles every day. So that's how I got my walking habits in shape.
This museum is here to preserve history, to educate future generations, to let them know about the price of freedom. As a World War II veteran, is there anything you think the rest of us need to know about what you and all those other men and women did 75 years ago and why it still matters today?
Well, you know, there's quite a few of us are around, and we would appreciate the younger people to respect this country, what we have done to help preserved freedom and all this freebies that we're getting that other countries are limited and forbidden to do. This is a good country to live in. I appreciate it. This country has done quite a bit for me and other fellows. Just keep respecting the flag and respect the older generation that put up their best time of their life to serve our country.
A few years ago, you went to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. You saw the National World War II Memorial. What was that like? What did you get out of that experience?
Well, I really enjoyed the flight. In fact, that's how I met you over there. We had a nice trip and really enjoyed it. I was very thankful for that. Seeing all those monuments and stuff like that, it really impressed me. Especially with the changing of the guard, that was something to see. And the Iwo Jima statue. putting up the flag, that was something to see, too. It's a great tour. I really appreciate it. That's a lifetime visit I'll never forget.
And I always like to ask guys, not to try to put a thought in their head or tell them what they should think, but I'm genuinely curious. So when you are at the National World War II Memorial, and you're looking, and here's this wall of gold stars representing 406,000 Americans who didn't come home, and you saw a lot of those guys in Europe. When you were at that memorial looking at that wall of gold stars, what was going through your mind?
I was amazed. Everything was so beautiful over there. That monument was beautiful. And looking at it, I said, geez, those guys gave it all they had. And they deserve something like this for remembrance and having people seeing what they have done.
And one of the men represented on that wall of gold stars, part of that heavy cost of freedom in World War II, was Ray's friend from Kalinga. Remember he talked about the customer at their Chinese restaurant who loved fried rice, the one they had nicknamed Apple? His name was Philip T. Mize, and Ray has never known what ended up happening to him. But thanks to today's technology and our interconnected worlds, I can tell you, a newspaper article from the end of World War II contained the names of 31 men from Kalinga who were killed in the war. But Philip Mize, at that point, was listed as still missing. His fate was yet unknown. He'd been in the Philippines before the war started, serving with the 19th Bomb Group. It wasn't until all the surviving prisoners of war returned that it became clear he had indeed been captured, had survived the infamous Bataan Death March, but then died in captivity. The Cabanatuan prison camp is the one that was famously liberated in a daring rescue that would become known as the Great Raid. But Philip Mize, Ray Lee's friend from Kalinga, passed away in that camp well before that rescue on June 24, 1942. His name is one of more than 2,700 listed on the Cabanatuan American Memorial, erected at the site of the former prison camp 30 years ago by those who survived their captivity there. I have linked a photo of Philip Mize's grave marker from the American Cemetery in Manila for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you can also find a video of Ray leading us around the museum collections he had such a big hand in building and maintaining for 27 years. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.